sitting in this week for David Tulip.
And we have a very wide range of both music and Shakespeare coming up today. We're going to be hearing certainly about the African-American Shakespeare Company, and we're going to be discovering the King of Cuba. And you may well be asking, who is the King of Cuba? Well, stay tuned, because you're going to find out. But first, I want to welcome to the studio David Finkel. He is the director, in fact, every little bit to do with music at Menlo. And over the years, they've just done a variety of different things. This is their 16th season. And we're going to hear a little bit of Brahms, which I think David will talk more about in a second, was one of their earlier pieces. Welcome, David, and let's just start with that little piece of music, which I know was from an earlier festival.
Well, Brahms was, of course, one of the greatest of all German romantic composers, and he thankfully wrote a great deal of fantastic chamber music. That was one of his early pieces, the piano quintet for piano and string quartet, and it was performed in one of our earlier festivals. We do manage to record all of our concerts and issue them on our recording label, which is called Music at Menlo Live.
Good. Now, I've just been going through the program, and it almost looks like a trip around Europe. So we have London, we have Paris, we have Berlin. So let's start with what you would hear at the London program. What music would be on tap then?
Well, this festival, like our other festivals, is a kind of a lens on the great and enormous art of classical music and classical chamber music in particular. And this year we decided to change that filter to being by city, since so much of the great music that we know and love comes from the great cities of the world. And we thought we would begin in London before crossing the channel to Paris. And so London had a very complicated musical history, as it has had a complicated political history, because so many composers, famous composers, visited London. For example, the first one up was George Frederick Handel, the German who actually made his home in London beginning in 1712, and never went back. And later we have composed another German, Felix Mendelssohn, who went there, but also earlier than Mendelssohn, Haydn went there, made a huge impact, and it wasn't until almost the 20th century that English composers seemed to come to the fore and take over once again. So our program features music of Handel, Mendelssohn, the visitors, but also of Ralph Vaughan Williams, also Benjamin Britten, who was a kind of a descendant of Elgar in some ways. And then we're winding up with a piece by Edvard Grieg, who visited London some five times and was very popular there. So the cities, the survey of the cities musically is not only about composers who were born there, who were native to the city, but those who visited and who were inspired by it.
And I see that's playing on Saturday, July the 14th.
Yep. Exactly.
That's it. And then we move on to Paris. And again, are we having musicians and composers who played in Paris, or are we sticking with French in this case?
Exactly. Well, all of the composers on the Paris program are French, with the exception of Franck, who is Belgian, but who moved to Paris and became one of the most prominent musicians there. Incidentally, Camille Saint-Saëns, most famous probably for his Carnival of the Animals, wrote incredible chamber music as well. And he was one of the earliest French composers to delve into the genre of chamber music. So we begin the program with his very first piano trio in F major.
That's on Thursday, July the 17th. And, of course, no program will be complete without St. Petersburg. Mm-hmm. And there it comes in the middle of the program. Which composers for St. Petersburg?
Well, Russia's chamber music history, Russia's classical music history is interesting and also complicated. Russia did not really give birth to its own native classical music until the 1830s. And that was in the hands of Mikhail Glinka, whose opera, A Life for the Tsar, sort of kicked off the Russian nationalist musical movement. We will hear a piece by Glinka, a fantastic trio for clarinet, bassoon, and piano. And then we'll have later romantics, Balakirev and Anton Arensky, and then venturing into the 20th century, music of Dmitri Shostakovich, who, of course, lived in a different era and wrote very different music, but equally expressive of Russia and its times.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the setting, because we go from chamber music, we have choral. What is the actual venue like where this takes place?
We have a couple of venues. We have first a venue for our lecture series called The Encounters. That is Martin Family Hall at Menlo School, which is in Atherton. And on that property, we also have a beautiful music room in a mansion there called Stent Hall, which is part of the Menlo School. But our main venue is the Center Performing Arts at the Menlo Atherton High School in Palo Alto, which seats some 500 people, but is still retains the kind of intimacy that we need for chamber music.
And in terms of the lectures, will these be introductions to different evenings or different composers? How do the lectures work?
Well, we're very organized this year. We have we have seven cities to deal with. So the first gentleman, Michael Parloff, who is a brilliant, brilliant speaker. He was the principal flutist of the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra for many years and now has a career as a presenter and a lecturer. He'll be tackling London, Paris, and St. Petersburg all in a two-hour span. And that's tomorrow night, actually, as a preface to the first three concerts. And then somebody else will take Leipzig and Berlin and yet another Budapest and Vienna.
Okay. So I'm looking at the Berlin evening, which is going to be July the 28th. And again, this has got a number of favorites running here, Beethoven, Mozart, Bach. In fact, do we need any more? Let's just hear about what pieces of those great composers you're going to be introducing.
Well, I think you can't have a Berlin concert without Mendelssohn on it, since he was such a central figure for that city. And the three gentlemen that you mentioned first, Beethoven, Mozart, and Bach, all were visitors to the city for various reasons. Beethoven went there as a young man trying to make a name for himself on tour. Mozart did the same thing, dedicating works to the King of Prussia. And Johann Sebastian Bach was very famously accosted there by Frederick the Great when he went to visit his own son, C.P.E. Bach, who was in the service of the king. So a lot of musical stories coming out of Berlin, and someday we'll get to the Berlin musical scene of the 1920s, which we don't do this year, but is equally fascinating.
And then we move literally up the river to Budapest, and it looks to me as though, again, we've got both visiting composers and native composers. So on July the 31st, the concert series will be looking at the city of Budapest.
Yeah. Budapest, of course, is precedes the evening of Vienna, which is the one that closes our festival. But the two cities are so inextricably linked. Geographically, they're close. Culturally, they've always been close. Vienna, of course, is a very in the very easternmost part of Austria. So it's very close to the countries of the Bohemian countries, to Hungary, to even to places like Slovenia. So the Viennese have always been entranced by the flavors of the Eastern European music. And of course, you know, Bartok and Kodály, who figure very prominently on this program, were the first to actually document their native land's folk music, incorporating it into their own music. Bartok's heir to that tradition was George Ligeti, who lived in the middle of the century in Budapest, but eventually fled the revolution of 1956, coming to the West and making a huge name for himself as the most prominent Hungarian composer of the second half of the 20th century.
And I see just before we go to that, mm-hmm. and I see the Bartok is a string quartet.
Oh, yes.
Let's speak a little bit about the different types of music in terms of chamber music, quartet, choral. How does that range go?
Well, we call chamber music everything from one instrument, which is technically a solo piece, but it works very well in a chamber-like setting, to duos, which are pieces written equally for two instruments. There's a great deal of equality in chamber music. You know, every part is important. There's only one person on a part, as opposed to an orchestra where you have many people on a single line. So we have everything from duos to trios to quartets made of different instruments, to string quartets, which is, of course, two violins, viola, and cello, quintets, which is a piano plus, it goes on, sextets, septets, nonets.
Sounds like tennis.
Yeah, it is. It's no, I mean, there are so many different combinations, and some composers, such as Bartok, latched on to the genre of, say, string quartet, and wrote six incredible string quartets. Mm-hmm. Many composers found the string quartet to be the most challenging and yet the most rewarding of chamber ensembles, and devoted a huge amount of energy to it.
Now, you yourself are a cellist. Are you actually playing in any of these?
I have always played the cello as my main profession. I still do. But now I also enjoy the great pleasure and privilege of artistic directing a project such as this.
And we finally finish in Vienna, and me with my popular strain thought there might have been a moment of Strauss, but we don't include Strauss in anything like this.
Why don't we say that things were Strauss-inspired?
Okay.
Ever since the elder Strauss came along. No. Vienna, of course, is arguably the greatest musical capital to have ever existed, or one could say that more great music was composed in Vienna than in any other city in the world, and one would not be inaccurate. We have three Viennas here. We have classical Vienna, which was dominated by Haydn, Mozart. We have late classical, which was Schubert, and we have the Romantic era, which was dominated by Schumann and Brahms. And then we venture towards the 20th century in what's called the Second Viennese School, with music of Arnold Schoenberg, his Transfigured Night, which is one of his last pieces that actually employs a recognizable tonality. It's an extremely romantic work, very mystical, very transcendent, and we find it a perfect way to close this festival.
Yeah, and I must say, this is just a beautiful brochure, because it gives you a sense of history, the art and illustrations, apart from telling you who's playing when. Beautifully put together program.
Thank you.
And this is music at Menlo, and is that the best way to contact you and get more information?
Yes, it's simply music@menlo.org. You have to spell out the A-T, it's not the at sign like on a computer.
Oh, that's important, because on the program is the A sign.
Well, that's our official name.
Okay, so that is Music at Menlo. I've been talking to David Finkel, and it's well worth a trip down the highway, down to Menlo, and just discover a wonderful range. And the whole festival runs from July the 13th, and in fact until early August, to August the 4th.
Correct.
Good. Thank you very much
for
coming in.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay.
Claim a few lines from Othello. and she'll think you're a hell of a fella.
If your blonde won't respond when you flatter her, tell her what Tony told Cleopatra.
If she fights...
Yes, well, it's that time of year when indeed we are going to brush up our Shakespeare. And we're not worrying about Othello this day, but we are concerned about Richard III. Now, what are we? Welcome Peter Kander here to the studio.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And the director,
Kirsten Brandt.
Hello. Kirsten Brown. So we have Richard III, one of the great favorites all time. Loved by actors, loved by audiences, but I think particularly appropriate today when we live in the world of fake news. And I think it's worth saying that the history of Richard III and Shakespeare's version of Richard III are not essentially two different people, but it very much was Tudor propaganda based largely on Thomas More. So let's start with you, Peter. How in terms of presentation, how do we present Richard in this particular production?
Great question. Richard is presented in this production in a very, I want to say stylized, but it's not going back to the Elizabethan. We are looking at a crisp, clear, very lean production. The set is very modern. It's very stylized. It's a runway. The lighting is very beautiful. The lighting is very technical, and it's almost technicolor in a sense. So we're looking to present this Richard in a contemporary way, in a way that audiences will look and say, well, I recognize that person. I recognize that person. I can recognize that person. I can get that language. I understand what that means. So there's nothing over the top about it at all. It's just Kirsten's clear vision of how we can contemporize this piece, look at it from a modern perspective, and have audiences say, yeah, that line, was that written 450 years ago? That could have been written today about a certain 45 or a certain other leader of this world from any other part of the world, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's what we're hoping that our audiences will pick up and take away from this production.
Now, Kirsten, Peter's mentioned a runway. So what does the set look like when you enter the theater?
It looks exactly like you're going to a fashion show. It's like a catwalk runway. This play teeters on the public and private, so you get a lot of public representation in terms of language and manipulation, but you also have a lot of private life happening behind the scenes in this play. And so there is a presentation quality to it, and so that's where the runway kicks in, is what happens on that runway and how do we present, almost like as if we were doing it for a camera or the live feed going out into across the nation.
And does the runway run into the audience? Is that part of it?
It does not. It just kind of bisects the proscenium.
So it is a play with a lot of strong women, almost violent women in it. And what would they be wearing, for example?
The women in this play, I think, are incredibly powerful. And if you look at this idea of the future being female, you have Lady Anne, you have Queen Elizabeth, you have Queen Margaret, and you have Richard's mother, the Duchess of York, and all of them are very different, powerful women in their own rights. And they're all contemporarily dressed. I mean, if you look at women in power now, from the Hillary Clintons to Maxine Waters to Kamala Harris to Queen Elizabeth, they're definitely a sartorial style in how they're depicted and know exactly what they're wearing in order to achieve a certain look, culture, you know, in the media.
And Peter, we talked a little early on, just before we came on mic, about Richard, deformity, hunch. We've had many classic ones. Anthony Sher immediately springs to mind. How does your Richard get about the stage?
Very similar. I always feel that if we take Richard and we bend him and shape him and put crutches and braces, I think the audience for the first 20 minutes are going to be like, oh, wow, look at all that stuff he's wearing. Look at all that stuff. How is he moving? Wow, that's interesting. Wow, he's got the cane. Look at that. Wow, he's going up and down the stairs in that. I think he's a very vain person. I don't think he sees himself with all that accoutrement. I think he sees himself as a very, he says, upon my life, she finds that although I cannot myself to be a marvelous proper man. And I think as the play goes on, yes, he's got this deformity, and yes, people look at him and point at him, but he sees himself beyond that, above that. So I'm not playing all that. It's there. And it's a walk that I have, and it's a deformity. But I think as the play goes forward and he gets more and more entrenched in the evil and the action of the play and the disparity of his life, that brings him down a little bit more and thus makes him more, it makes it harder for him to straighten up when all this stuff is on his back, bringing him down. You know, I will bear the burden on my back, he talks about. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think as the play goes on, you will see Richard just barely being able to hold himself up. But as the play begins, oh, he's well-dressed. He's wearing a black suit. He's wearing a black shirt tie. He's very well-mannered. He's got this deformity on this left side of his body. But that's just part of who he has been all his life.
So I'm thinking, because I've seen a couple of modern or contemporary versions of Richard, you know, particularly one where he's depicted almost in Nazi Third Reich type, and I think about that line, a horse, a kingdom for a horse, and in one they changed it, a kingdom for a tank.
Mm, mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering how, in contemporary terms, how do we deliver that line, a horse, a kingdom for a horse?
Well, go ahead, Kirsten. Thank you.
The language doesn't, you know, we're both lovers of Shakespearean language, and so to change horse to tank kind of lands it in a really strange way that just doesn't feel right. And so Peter does say that line.
I do say it, as a matter of fact, twice. Look, I am, as Kirsten said, and we both share this, I love Shakespeare. I love the language. I've done 27 of his plays. I've directed 5 or 6 of his plays. Language is very important to me. However, in modern day language, in modern day audiences, we must trim. We must trim the fat. Sometimes it gets too archaic, and that's terrific. But that line is so, it's like trimming. It's like saying, to be or not to be, that is the thought.
Yeah, right.
it doesn't land well. So the line is there. You will see no horses. You mm-hmm. will see. There's a battle at the very end, of course, with
and
Richmond.
How do we do the battle?
Well, you'll have to come and see.
Yes.
Oh, I'm not going to give away theater magic.
it's also very stylized.
It's contemporary.
And it's very contemporary, so, yes.
But no, there are no horses. Shutting across the stage.
Right.
I don't think they'd let us do that in the theater anyway.
No, we brought one horse in and they poo-pooed it.
Okay.
No, we didn't. Actually, we didn't bring any horses in.
And the other thing I associate with Richard, he's the villain that you want to love. And I think that sort of contradiction has partly to do with trust. And I make the comparison, because I mentioned fake news early on, whether there was any comparison to today's Richard. Do we see any presidents hopping onto this stage in terms of the character of Richard?
Well, I think I hope that from the very first line, now is the winter of our discontent made glorious summer by this son of York, to a horse, my kingdom for a horse. I think you will see and hear parallels to our current situation. You just cannot help it. There are moments in the play that Kirsten and I have little, as they call them in video games, what are they called? Hidden messages in video games. Anyway. Mushrooms. No.
Easter eggs.
Easter eggs, that's right. Okay. So that we hope that the audience will pick up. But there are subtle mentions and subtle gestures that I do. But also, Richard holds on to, grasps, embraces a certain type of people. Mm-hmm. When he has his asides, was ever woman in this humor wooed? Was ever woman in this humor won? There are people out there who will say, he's talking to me. Oh my gosh. I'm part of Richard. Richard is talking to me. And there are parallels to our current situation where there are a certain amount of people who will embrace a certain president no matter what he says, no matter what he does, no matter what, how crazy moments could be. They are still going to say, that is my president.
Mm-hmm.
So I think with Richard, he has these beautiful sides to the audience. He's actually walking into the audience. He may sit with the audience. Not that there'll be any chairs available. in for the show, not that there'll be any seats available, but there are moments there that he's actually talking to them and embracing them and caressing and cajoling, not caressing, but cajoling them into his way of thinking. And it works.
And it's a very, I think, in a good sense, a manipulative device, because
correct.
You're sharing the inner thoughts. It's almost like an internal monologue, mm-hmm. where you know what's going on inside his head. The other characters may not know what's going on inside his head. So that sharing with the audience becomes an integral bit of, I'm going to say, manipulation in terms of contact. And in this particular theater, how many seats, just remind me?
Oh, gosh. Three and change?
About 300 or so.
How big is the theater?
It's about 300.
It's about 300. It's the Toby Atrium 401 Van Ness on the fourth floor. It's where the San Francisco Opera performs. Beautiful space.
Yeah. So there is that sense of intimacy. You're not playing way up to the gallery or too
right.
far out.
Right.
And I think that's where, this is what it's like in an Italian opera. They will often stop the music while the character moves forward, tells us what's on, and then suddenly bop smack again. So I think that sense of intimacy is the secret for how we come to understand the conspiratorial mind of Richard. And I think it's also a play about betrayed trust.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I mean, loyalty being one of Richard's mottos in the play. And when he betrays the trust to the audience, I mean, he is directly engaging with us from the very first moment, and then slowly as the play progresses and the evil becomes more and more
prominent,
yes, mm-hmm. he stops talking to us and mm-hmm. he starts to drift away, and so we're no longer let in, so we're allowed to view what it is he's done that we as an audience have been implicated in with him, because we watched him do it and didn't stop him. So it really becomes a very interesting moral dilemma for I think an audience while they're watching.
And do we have the murder of the princes? Is that part of?
Oh yes, we do. Mm-hmm.
Okay. We
allude to it, and we have the repercussions of that play out, and you see how that affects everyone. But this is not a easy play in terms of people surviving.
Right.
There's a lot of death and destruction in this history play.
There's a lot of people being fired.
Yes.
Right. That's that's probably the ultimate metaphor I think we were waiting to hear. But fired means not just dismissed, but dead on the plane,
correct.
Dead on the floor. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it sounds like a very exciting production. And when does it run? What are the dates that, if you want to go to the theater, you can catch this particular production?
We open July 14th and run through July 29th, playing on Saturdays at 8 and Sundays at 3 o'clock. And you can find out about us at AfricanAmericanShakes.org, and that's African-AmericanShakes.org.
Okay, I'm going to get you to repeat
that. There are limited performances, so please get your tickets.
Sure.
Yeah, and let's have that website or ticket address one more time.
Yeah, it is the African-AmericanShakes.org, African-AmericanShakes.org.
And this is Richard III, and I've been talking to Peter Callender and Kirsten Brown. I want to thank you both for coming in and certainly giving us a real hot Shakespearean tragedy history, call it what you will, and see what happens and make sure it is the summer of your major content rather than
thank
discontent.
You so much, Peter. And I just want to give the address. It's 401 Van Ness. It's the San Francisco Opera Building. And a special thank you to the San Francisco Opera for their support, and to Bart for their support as well. Thank you. I so very, very much appreciate
good.
It.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
both for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you. A San Francisco le canto mi mambo, a San Francisco le canto mi cha cha cha, a San Francisco le canto mi mambo, a San Francisco le canto.
Well, already my hips are shaking and I'm absolutely vibrating back here to hear the timpani, the music, and this of course is what you will hear at the opening of the King of Cuba. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Margot Gomez, who plays El Presidente or El Comandante.
Yes, Marga Gomez.
Marga.
Yes.
Okay. And playwright Cristina Garcia, both welcome to KLW.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks, Peter. And hola.
Hola. ¿Cómo está? ¿Está bien? Okay. Oh, hey, yeah, here we go. Yeah, right. Welcome from...
Hey, compadres.
Okay.
Bienvenidos.
So let's start with the title of this play, King of Cuba. I know it's set in relatively contemporary times. It is about two octogenarians looking back on times gone by. But why king? Why King of Cuba?
Well, the King of Cuba refers to pretty much all Cuban men, because if they were raised in the arms of a Cuban mommy, every single one of them considers themselves the center of the universe. So King of Cuba refers to both El Comandante as well as his exile nemesis.
Would-be assassin.
And would-be assassin, mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm.
And let's go over to you, Marga, about the character you're playing, El Comandante. again, an 80-year-old who is reflecting on how times have changed.
He's an 80-something, yes, facing his 90th birthday. It's an honor to be in this play. I've worked for about 25 years as a solo performer and was just given the invitation to play El Comandante. Now, I am also half Cuban, and so I never really could decide on Castro's impact. And what this play is about is a character. It's a satire, and it's sort of in, you know, a take on the leader of Cuba. Of course, Castro passed a couple of years ago, but I play a it's called, he's a tyrant, but in his own mind, of course, he's a hero. And mm-hmm. to many, he's a hero.
Mm-hmm.
So I am playing an old Cuban dude, and I have played an old Cuban dude before, my father. This is, of course, very, very different. And,
And let's go over to you, Cristina. The play has two central settings. One is in Miami, and then the other setting set in Havana. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. And it reflects the big divide of the Cuban people since 1959. And it tries to... I think of it as a sort of equal opportunity skewering of both sides, that and a look at the false dichotomy between the two, many of the similarities and the intransigencies that keep us hostage to the situation for over six decades. And by the way, Marga's being way too modest. I wrote that role for her after seeing her work, and I thought there was nobody better who could examine and interrogate Cuban masculinity better than Marga Gomez. And she does a fabulous job, and I laugh every rehearsal nonstop.
Now, I think anyone who does that history knows that that magic word, Bay of Pigs, turns up. So how does that feature in this particular play?
The play opens on the anniversary of the victory of the Cuban people over the attack at the Bay of Pigs, which was backed by the CIA and exiles who were trying to take the island back from the revolutionaries. So Bay of Pigs.
Yeah, well, the Bay of Pigs is one of those seminal events on both sides of the Straits of Florida. For Cuba, it was their great triumph, the thing that they could always point to in terms of thumbing their noses at the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, on the exile side, it was also the reason why all the Cubans went Republican, you know, of that generation. They felt betrayed. They felt Kennedy had abandoned them at the last minute with air support. And so that has become a touchstone for both sides. So it also seemed a perfect place to illuminate their differences, a place to focus on.
So let's talk about some of the other characters who make up the story, maybe name one or two of them.
Well, the nemesis of El Comandante is named Goyo Herrera, played by Stephen Ortiz. We have a fabulous all-Latinx cast, plus a master percussionist, Carlos Caro, and we're all working in concert to transport you to the Caribbean.
And we heard Carlos opening this segment. That was his music. He's a Grammy Award-winning percussionist, and it's really a treat as he's entered a rehearsal process because he is like another character, another actor. And so when you come in, it's a very cerebral piece. It's a satire where, it's an equal opportunity offender, and yet I think when you see this piece, there's such a hope for reconciliation between the two voices of the Cuban people, those who have left the island and those who stayed on the island. But the music, the percussion, the soul of it is in Carlos' hands. And then the energy of it is in this cast, this ensemble cast. I mean, I'm very frustrated because the physical, situation here at this beautiful small jewel of a theater, Central Works in the Berkeley City Club is so that I've never seen a show like this, but it's very immersive for the audience. It's very intimate space, but I am never going to be able to see the other actors. Like, in the rehearsal process, yes, but once we really get into the show, which is coming up soon, we're all going to be outside, and then we enter through like these little doors, but there's no...
I'll give you a full report, Mark.
Okay, thank you.
So I think the intimacy is important because the seating there is how many in the
theater? It's a 50-seat theater, and it's three sides around,
right.
And people are coming in and out of three doors, and you could be in the audience standing a foot or two away from the characters.
It's miraculous how Gary Graves and the crew at Central Works just put on these shows where you feel you've been at a 500-seat theater and you're actually in this, you know, Julia Morgan-designed room. Yeah,
it's very immersive. And just another note on the music, it becomes the landscape of the play. Yes, we're in near downtown Berkeley, but the music transports us to Havana, transports us to Miami, and that's...
The spirit of place. It really brings the spirit of place.
Yes, the music... takes us there.
And also the comical voice, because there's there are no rim shots, but there's humor in the percussion and the timing and the placement of the music as well.
Yeah. So what sort of costumes, what are people wearing to capture the 60 years, the contemporary, the past, the history?
We have a great costume designer who's worked with Central Works, Tammy Berlin, I think is her last name.
That's her name.
And she is... You know, she's no nonsense. She started out as a director in Chicago. Now she's doing the costumes. I personally have as you know, Castro, you know, fatigue ensemble. Mm-hmm. I have pajamas, which is my favorite scene because I get to wear pajamas and man slippers.
You're very fetching in those pajamas. Yeah.
Okay. But, of course, Castro in his later years, again, it's not Castro, but, you know, he is my role model in my character. He wore these incredible tracksuits, Adidas tracksuits, like a hip-hop star. So we have some of those.
I wonder if he got royalties. You know, he wore them so often.
Okay.
But I don't know.
Well, he was always working angles to, you know, support the
revolution. Tourism to their country.
Well, he was originally a lawyer, so he must have fitted in. Now, we haven't talked much about the other octogenarian who comes from New York. And in the story, you knew this other person in the basis of the story in the old days.
That's right. He was a college chum, but, you know, he was in the periphery of Castro's orbit or Comandante's orbit in the university. Yeah.
And has he changed his thinking over the years?
Oh, well, I think it's ossified over the years. He considered El Comandante, before he was El Comandante, a criminal and a troublemaker back in the early 50s when they were both college students. And he was displaced by the revolution. And not only that, but El Comandante stole his beloved. And so right. There is just no remedy for that. And he has carried this injury comically and otherwise for decades.
And this character, Goyo, has a millennial Cuban-American daughter and a son who's sort of not quite all there. And so the three of them try to get to Havana for this Bay of Pigs celebration and Comandante's 90th birthday. And so you see the second generation of Cuban descent, young people who are perhaps not even interested in the whole
story.
anger and the struggle.
And tell me, if you weren't doing this play in Berkeley, but you're actually in Little Havana in Florida, how do you think audiences would respond to it there?
Oh, I don't know. I keep trying to write things that will get me run out of town, but the opposite happens because I think I try and... For example, this Goyo exile character, he's done with a great deal of affection and humor. Mm-hmm. And I think my own father, who is of that vintage, would probably be seduced by him and feel like, well, she got that side of it, too. And so I think there's a little something for all political persuasions.
So it's a multidimensional portrayal.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yeah.
If I can just jump in here. Christina has been a hero of mine since I read her book, Dreaming in Cuban, which came out, was it 1992. 92. And she's an award-winning novelist, and this is the first play of hers to have a production. She worked with Central Works in developing the play, and so this is a world premiere, and this is also Christina's debut as a playwright, although she is a world-renowned novelist and published in different languages.
So the book was written originally in 1992?
No. My first novel came out then, but this novel came out in 2013. And so, but this is the very first adaptation or playwriting I've done. And I don't know that I'll ever go back to my novel writing cave again.
Especially she likes collaborating.
Yeah, especially if I get to work with Marga. Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, when you read a novel, you, the reader, put the sound of the words in your head. You're then in the drama form, and suddenly an actor is speaking those words. So, did you learn something yourself?
It's an astonishing experience. I felt like I was blown back against the wall the first time people were saying these words aloud. It was so exciting for me. You never get to really see your readers. Reading a novel is a very intimate experience for me as well, between two sensibilities. This is another order of engagement altogether, which I find thrilling.
I have a similar experience because I've been doing a solo performance since 92 and stand-up. And so to be in a play like this and to work with a director and to be directed in an ensemble is a different experience. And I tend to think about building my character in scenes as I did as a solo performer, where I peopled the stage with the characters that I played. And now I actually get to bounce off other people. So it's...
Okay, so the play is called The King of Cuba. Do you want to give us a website where we can find out more about this? It's at the City Club in Berkeley.
Yes, you can go to centralworks.org for more information and tickets, or you could call 510 858-1381 for your tickets. Our opening night is sold out, but there are seats. The show is opening July 21st, but running through mid-August.
Okay,
runs and through August 19th, yes.
Runs through mid-August. It's called The King of Cuba and sounds like a lively, fun, satirical evening, giving you a very multi-dimensional view of Cuba.
Hope to see you there.
Good. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you, Peter.
Okay. Well, we have gone the full range of music today. We've gone from Cuba to Shakespeare. We kicked off down in Menlo. And now we're moving north to the Valley of the Moon Music Festival. And, Eric, I want you to tell us a little bit about what we've just been listening to.
Well, that is the Mendelssohn D minor piano trio. And it's I'm playing the piano. My partner and we're fellow directors of this music festival. Tanya Tompkins is playing the cello, and Monica Huggett is playing the violin. She's a very well known Baroque violinist, but she also loves to play classical and romantic music. And we have a trio with her, and we also play as part of this music festival. And it's played on original or sometimes called period instruments. So the piano is an 1841, sometimes called a forte piano, but it's just an antique piano, actually originally made then and fully restored. And the strings are playing, and Tanya and Monica are playing on gut strings and set up in the way they would have been in the 19th century. And we think it, in a way, sounds fresh and modern that way, because the sounds are more immediate. There's more articulation, and the balances are better. Sometimes it's very difficult not to drown out the string players with a piano playing. And so,
are all the different evenings on the 18th century, or is it just one particular evening?
That was just on one piece on one program, but we specialize in classical and romantic music on period instruments. So generally we go from about 1750 to 1850, 1860. This year, with our concentration on Vienna, we wanted to go a little bit further into the early 20th century. So we have the Schönberg Second String Quartet, which is verging on atonality, but was written for gut strings, and so we're giving it that performance that it on similar to what it would have had when it was written. So we see the whole history of Vienna. Our first piece, I think, was written in the 1760s by von Hall all the way till Schönberg. So that's our... but there's a lot of... when you think about period instruments, people think about a lot of Baroque playing, but we specialize in those.
So you're coming in after the Baroque, essentially.
Right. Yep. And mm-hmm. So no harpsichords and things like that, but we have all the different... We have different pianos. We also have a copy of an earlier piano from the 18th century piano, so we take two pianos up there. So that's our concentration.
And how big is the setting in terms of hearing these instruments?
Well, it's an auditorium, but it's a small auditorium. It seats about 200 or 250 maximum. And we have an acoustic shell that makes it kind of sound like you're in a room. A lot of these pieces, some of them were written for maybe bigger auditorium-sized places, and some of them were written to be played in a small room. But we think we create a little bit of that atmosphere, but we are able to invite a couple hundred people in to hear it that way.
And I see there are at least 8 different evenings running from the 14th of July, so starting finishing at the end of July.
That's right. The 15th is the first public concert. We have 6 concerts, public concerts, starting on Sunday, the 15th, this coming Sunday, and then on weekends, starting then Saturday and Sunday, the next 2 weekends through the 29th. The concerts are mostly at 4 p.m. There's one on Sunday, the 29th, at 11. And there's, since it's Sonoma, there's wine served on the patio afterwards, so that's part of the experience. And so we have those concerts, and we also have some lectures. That's what you're seeing as extra events. And so 2 of the lectures on the 15th and on the 21st, there's going to be lectures at 3 p.m. That's anybody attending the concert can come to the lecture. And then on the 29th is sort of our grand finale day, where we have the 2 concerts, one at 11, one at 4. And then in between, there'll be a lecture that you can buy separately. That's actually an event that you pay for separately on that day. So if you want, you can come here, 2 concerts and a lecture all on that one
and
Sunday.
And this title for one of them, you know, Vienna Transformed, and then we move to Vienna Coffee House. Are we following this music chronologically? Is that how we're trying to put this together?
Well, often each individual program may go in chronological order, although we don't make a rule of it. But we're not necessarily doing that. In the Vienna Transformed program, we're trying to show, it's like a miniature version of the entire festival, where we're trying to show kind of how Vienna was transformed and how the music was transformed from the classical style of Mozart all the way through Schoenberg. And we'll have the lecturer talking about history around that time, with because it's pretty complicated during the time of the right before the First World War, when some of the things that were starting to happen politically and socially around then, so was pretty transformed. And yet you can see the continuity of the history. And I think playing all the music on gut strings and on period instruments kind of will help to show that.
And did we bring another piece of music, which again is coming in which particular concert?
Well, no, this piece is actually a comparison, because we wanted people to hear what the same Mendelssohn trio sounded like in a very good performance with Lang Lang playing piano and a couple of string players on modern instruments. And what you can listen for is that it's a fine performance. But you can hear that there's a lot of vibrato, which is how steel strings play. And then the piano is a little bit rounder and a little less articulate. So in order not to drown out the string instruments on the big modern piano, you kind of have to it's hard to be as clear. So you might not pick out as many of the notes. What I love about the period instruments is that you can hear everything very clearly, and yet the balances are good. So you can hear.
And is the pedals a difference on these 2 different types of piano?
Well, I just think that the sound, we still use a sustaining pedal on the old piano, so it's a very similar mechanism, but just the sound is more articulate of the old piano. It's more the sound of the instrument itself, and I think you'll hear the difference right away.
Okay. So this is a contrast between the 18th century instruments, which you will be hearing in different pieces, and then that was a contemporary piece. And as Eric was explaining, the cellist, Tanya Tompkins, is actually playing on an 18th century. This piano was a contemporary piano. So we got a contrast in two different types.
Right. What you heard before was those period instruments, and what you heard now is the modern performance. So you can hear it's a different world. And I enjoy playing the older instruments and with players playing the older instruments, because it just makes everything come out clearly, and it's a joy to play those instruments. So.
And what we have been listening to is parts of different pieces of music from the Valley of the Moon Music Festival, which actually opens July 15th. It runs through the entire month of July, finishes on July 29. And tell me, Eric, if people want to get more information, what's a good website number?
Yes, the website is www.valleyofthemoonmusicfestival.org. And if you just look up Valley of the Moon Music Festival, you'll find it. And all our concerts and our lectures and all the information will be there.
And it really has a full range of different aspects. It's the progress, the history of Vienna, moving from the 18th century right down to music written shortly before the outbreak of the First World War. There are also lectures and talks, and I think on both the 29th, you've actually got a panel talking about different aspects of the country.
Yes, we'll have Kate Van Orden, who's a Harvard musicologist, talking with just us musicians about what it's like to play.
Yes. So, again, we're going to ask you for that website again. So that
yes, absolutely, valleyofthemoonmusicfestival.org.
And I've been speaking to Eric Zimian. He is the music director for Valley of the Moon Music Festival. Certainly worth a trip up north, brace Northern California, hear great sounds, enjoy wonderful instruments, and discover something you may not have known before about Vienna.
Well, thank you very much, and we hope to see some of you there.
Thanks. Good. Good to come. Thank you. You have been listening to Open Hour. I'm Peter Robinson, this week sitting in for David LaTulip. We've had a full range of cultural happenings here in San Francisco. KLW Open Hour is the program that covers arts and culture here in the Bay Area. The program was produced by Neil Swingles, and once again doing the wonders of the keyboard, editing, putting it all together behind the scenes, thanks to Damien. We're now going to hear something just to bring a little smile to your face this afternoon. Nat King Cole, and here we go, Smile.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by. If you smile through your fear and sorrow, smile and maybe tomorrow, you'll see the sun come shining through. For you, light up your face with gladness, hide every trace of sadness, although a tear may be ever so near. That's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile.
And you've been listening to Open Air with guest host Peter Robinson here on 91.7 FM.